Hello and welcome. It's been a week which has seen France finally appoint a new prime minister, a mountain-hiking, smooth-talking septuagenarian, Michel Barnier, Monsieur Brexit, the former EU point man negotiating Britain's divorce. He served in the cabinet of many French presidents in decades gone by. Now he's back, the oldest PM in the French Fifth Republic, replacing that man, the youngest one. But why Barnier, and why did he want the job? Is it because he's a master of eggshell diplomacy?
We are in a serious moment. Gabriel Attal mentioned it earlier. I approach this period, this new chapter that is opening, with great humility. Perhaps the wisdom that comes with grey hair, the kind needed for this new chapter.
Celle qu'il faut pour que cette nouvelle page qui commence.
It's been a week which has seen some of the biggest protests against the Netanyahu government in Israel, and a national strike after the killing of six hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. The Prime Minister accused of having blood on his hands and a lack of humanity in blocking truce deals that may have prevented the deaths. He denied the claims, but he did offer an apology.
I told the families, and I repeat it tonight too, I ask for your forgiveness for not bringing them back alive. We were close, but we didn't succeed.
This has been a week that the tweeting, or Xing, fell silent in Brazil. The social media platform X is now officially an X social media platform in Brazil after a disinformation row rose up between a Supreme Court judge and the site's owner, billionaire, self-proclaimed free speech absolutist Elon Musk. Has Brazil done the right thing? Welcome to the world this week. Back to the office, week one. And we have, 109 days, I think, until Christmas. So don't despair. We're with you for every Friday up until then. And amongst the world's press corps in the studio this week, Richard Worley, backed by popular demand. And I must say, a seasoned journalist, World Affairs watcher, correspondent with the Swiss publication Blick, author of the book, The Ball of Illusions, How France, What France Believes and What the World Sees. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Also, Caroline Dillard, correspondent in Paris for the German broadcaster ARD. Great to have you with us this evening, particularly on a night where Germany will also be in the news. Brasilia, let's go there. Sergio Spaniolo, founder and managing editor of the news agency Vault Data Lab, editor of Brazilian fact-checking website EOS Fatos. We have a lot to talk about with Elon Musk tonight. Great you have on the programme with us, Sergio. And also Nico Hines. Thank you, Sergio. Nico is in London, regular, always eagle-eyed contributor to The World This Week, the world editor of The Daily Beast. Great to have you on the programme. Great to have you on the board too, Nico. So let's begin.
Good evening.
French Prime Minister. The salary, €180,000 a year. The challenge, heading up the most fragile French government in decades, getting a budget passed by October the 1st and avoiding a vote of no confidence that would result in being out on your ear within weeks. Step-up career politician Michel Barnier, a surprise announcement on Thursday lunchtime. He is President Monsieur Macron's choice for stability. A blast from the Brexit past, who served as chief EU negotiator for 2 years as UK left in the EU. 2 years I remember well as Brussels correspondent. 2 years I will never get back. Well, he's used to politics getting ugly, keeps a calm head in a time of crisis. And this choice of a 73-year-old doyen of the centre-right means he's the oldest Prime Minister of the Fifth Republic, replacing the youngest one. Let's take a look at the crowning moment.
We will strive to respond as much as we can to the challenges, the anger. You have mentioned them, the suffering, the feeling of abandonment, of injustice that permeates far too many of our cities, neighbourhoods and rural areas. I'm also thinking about the control of immigration. I will do everything to meet their expectations and hopes. There you have it. Thank you very much. Let's get to work.
According to one French analyst this week, it is no wonder there hasn't been a large queue to take on the job in such a febrile political climate. because, quote, it takes one who must be either servile or suicidal. Richard, is Prime Minister Barnier servile or suicidal?
I don't think so. He may have been servile in the past. He has a long career as a politician. He has always been a conservative, belonging to the Conservative Party. I mean, it used to be the UMP, then Les Républicains today. So he's a man of a dedication, of loyalty. And when you are such a man, sometimes you have to be servile, especially at times of President Chirac. He had to swallow some difficult pills, I would say. But now he's getting older, way older, 73 years old, he's got nothing to prove. He's been negotiator for the EU, and some say that negotiating with the Brits is the most difficult thing in the world. He's done it. He's done it for the EU, so he's got nothing to lose. And that's why I think he's not suicidal either, because he is in a position where he can get a success. It does not mean he will get it. He has to slalom through to find a majority, but that goes well with his CV because he's a good skier. He knows about skis coming from the Alps, so maybe it will help.
And brought in the Winter Olympics, you don't miss a beat, Richard. Caroline, it's interesting just listening to what Richard's talking about in terms of being servile, yes, in the past, but what do you think the thinking would have been for Michel Barnier? Is it that he's got nothing to lose, or does he think, actually, I can create something here?
I think he does. I mean, what I found interesting is when we look back at this moment of the passation de pouvoir, when they actually handed over power to one another, there was the young guy actually taking a place that wasn't originally his in that precise moment. So he was just talking. He kept on talking forever, saying how frustrated he was to have to actually leave the position that he took on with a great sense of responsibility, in my opinion. And then the other one actually saying, oh, I like how you give me lessons. So actually what I perceived was a kind of power play in this very precise moment.
A touch of
moment.
Irony, you mean, when he
exactly.
said
exactly. And I think that both of them are the type of politicians who actually search for this. They search for the challenge. And I think that Michel Barnier is a very experienced negotiator, a very experienced diplomat, but he's not going to have an easy time.
What did you make of the fact that in that same conversation with the youngest ever French PM of the Fifth Republic and the oldest, and the Michel Barnier is saying it takes a man of grey hair to take on this job?
Actually, I was like, really now? Mm-hmm. Sorry, maybe I had this kind of, come on, do we really have to take the conversation to that level moment? But then again, I think that his experience, and experience is nothing to do with age in the first place, but I think that his experience was one of the main reasons why he was chosen, and I think it can only be a good thing in this situation, of course.
Nico, what were you doing when Michel Barnier was announced? Were you shocked? What was the sense that you had?
Yeah, we were absolutely shocked over here. I mean, it must be the first time in world history where the incoming French Prime Minister, just freshly announced, is better known in Britain than he is in France. You know, he was an absolute household name over here, having been the face of the Brexit negotiations from the EU point of view. So, yeah, I think depending on which side of the debate you were on Brexit over here, he was either a sort of strange hero or he was the villain of the piece. But I think he's actually got a very good reputation over here. You know, he was famous. There was a famous shot where he arrived for some of the negotiations with David Davis, who was one of our rotating band of buffoons sent over to Brussels to try and hammer out this deal. And the photograph was taken of the table, and on Barnier's side they all had these huge binders with all this information and they were ready to go, and on the David Davis Britain side it was just they had empty hands, there was nothing in front of them, and it became this sort of emblematic moment of the Brexit negotiations. And I think most people over here were rather impressed with Barnier. And of course, not only did he deal with people like Boris Johnson and, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Lord Frost and all these difficult characters from Britain, he was also keeping 27 different EU nations in line as well. And they all had their own opinions on how Brexit should be negotiated. So I do think he's had the absolute best possible build-up to being thrown into the deep end of trying to make peace in this crazy French Parliament.
2 points actually really interesting there, Nico. First of all, on David Davis, a little known fact. My producer and I once had a chat with him in Brussels. She made him a cup of tea. She said, how many sugars? He said, 5. Keep going until they don't dissolve anymore. That's the sort of man David is. XTA, Territorial Army. Now, talking about Michel Barnier, Richard, this is interesting because I've met him, I've interviewed a number of times. I don't know if you've met him. He's very particular.
Like, yes. For example, I met him several times when he was in his previous job as EU Commissioner for Financial Markets. At that time, I was in Brussels, so it's interesting to compare our point of view.
So that would have been, right. So you were talking about the time of Jack Straw as well.
True.
When he was
exactly.
in the UK. So he would be like this. You do an interview with him, everything's straight, pen here, precise. It's a man of the moment. He's also interesting because he wanted not to be prime minister. He wanted a few weeks ago to be president and kind of ruled out being prime minister. And if I'm right in saying, you know, Nico said he's well known in the UK. Some like him, others not so. The reports are that President Sarkozy once suggested he had the charisma of an oyster.
That's not untrue. I mean, he's not a man of charisma. He's not a man that you would be attracted to if he's in a room. As a young man, he was quite handsome. He's tall. I understand he had quite a success with women. But in terms of magnetism, he has no magnetism. That's not his card. His card is more, I would say, a coach in sport. He's a teamwork person. He has always had a team behind him. That's why it's going to be very interesting to know who he managed to recruit as ministers. So he's a man of a teamwork. And secondly, he's a man who keeps his track. He's not deviating. Once he set up an objective, he goes for it. And I think that's what made him win the European side and the European trust. He was not the kind that would go regularly to Paris to consult or to Berlin and change his mind. He set a cape in Brussels, and then he managed to bring all EU countries together for the sake of this goal. And I think that's what he's very good at. So we can expect from him a certain righteousness and a certain, I would say, he's patient, but stubborn.
Sticking with that, Caroline, I want to... No, tell me first. Tell me.
No, because I think it's very interesting what Richard just mentioned, this sense of actually having an objective and being stubborn, but in a good way. Mm. And I think this actually, in this situation, is something that the country really needs and also that President Macron really needs. Because by nominating Michel Barnier, he has someone who actually, in terms of content, in terms of political objectives, especially regarding economic and social policy, they're quite aligned. But Michel Barnier will not be the one who seems servile to the president. And I think that in the situation that we have, this is the best that Macron could get out of the situation. I think afterwards, we will have to see how well this works in the crazy parliament. But I think the profile is kind of interesting, and especially what the situation might need.
It is. You talked about a power play earlier with him and Gabriel Attal and that being part of this challenge. And also, just to extend the profile that Richard talked about as well, this man who was a dashing youth and actually cares about his appearance. There is a story. This is by Lord Miners, who is a British former city minister in the UK, former chairman of the Tate Gallery, who said that he invited Mr. Barnier into the Treasury years ago. And he came in, started looking at the artwork and thought, this guy really loves his art. And he claims all he was doing was look at the reflection, checking his hair was OK in each shot. Nico, I don't know if that's true or not, but the point is that this is a man who takes care of himself.
Yeah, he definitely projects an extremely impressive sheen. And I think that, you know, at least if nothing else, it does give the impression that Macron is handed over to somebody who's a kind of safe pair of hands, who knows what they're doing, who's going to be very professional, who's going to be very polite and diplomatic. Of course, the reality of this situation is much rougher and much darker. Mm. And who knows what conversation he's had with Marine Le Pen behind the scenes. It was very obvious to hear him sort of randomly bringing up immigration in that clip you played before, which didn't sort of seem to fit into what he was talking about. So we shall see in terms of how much he's being manipulated and forced into dark alleys from behind, because this is going to be an absolute nightmare trying to navigate his way through these competing factions.
I heard one MP describe it as not the end of political chaos, but the next chapter for political chaos. Richard and Carolyn, if we look at, you know, the challenge ahead now, you have the left, which won the elections, and they say he's not representative. But yet they won, they didn't get 100 or so seats more that they needed to win by a majority. So you have to represent the centre and the right. Emmanuel Macron, the president, says that he consulted to the left, but he just couldn't find and fix on somebody that would work. The likes of Lucie Castet and Bernard Cazeneuve, but he didn't test them out. So potentially that's a problem. So the question, well, it's in front of us on the screen. For both of you, how long do you think this new prime minister can last?
I will not say how long he's going to last, but I think that a very important indicator will be the 1st of October when the budget consultations in the parliament are going to start. I think what Nico just said is right. Behind the choice that we finally have, there's a very, very dark reality. And by saying that actually the profile is the best that President Macron could actually get out of the situation, I'm not saying that Michel Barnier will be the one who will actually put things right. So I'm not sure whether he can last very, very long. And the dramatic thing that is connected to the situation is that it is mostly up to the Rassemblement National, to the far right, to decide on his fate.
Richard, if I come back to this program, Caroline saying, we'll wait. I say, you told me, where are we now? We are the 6th of September and you got it right. So what is it? What's your prediction?
Well, I think he will last. And I will tell you why. Because to last in this divided parliament where no political party has absolute majority and there is a need for coalition, what he needs at the moment most urgently is to make sure that there is no a coalition against him. What we call motion de censure, so not to have a coalition that can vote a censorship motion, so he has to resign. And to manage that, you need one thing. You need to make sure that the extreme right, the Rassemblement National, will not vote with La France Insoumise, the radical left. So you've got to make sure that those two parties who have all together around 220 votes, so absolute majority is 289, so they have only 70 votes to find to topple the government. But if he managed to introduce kind of, I would say, a divide line between the two, if he managed not to avoid the subject that could make them come together, especially on social issues, then he has a chance. And I think that's what he will do. Now, is he, and Nico was mentioning it, is he negotiating under the table, behind the curtain, with the Rassemblement National? It is possible, because remember, keep in mind that when he was candidate for the presidency, that was a year and a half ago, he had a very strong stance on immigration. Yeah. He wanted a moratorium on immigration, and if we would come again with that idea, that would certainly please the extreme right.
Sergio, in Brasilia, I'm interested in how the slings and arrows of French politics have been reported in Brazil and the sense that, well, of how chaotic it's coming across for those reading or those watching social media or TV in Brazil.
Well, a lot of the French news that we have been getting here has a lot to do with Pavel Durov and his arrest last week. Since Telegram is a very big tool here as well, we pay close attention to that. Brazilian politicians are not very active in talking about the prime minister, the new prime minister. But yeah, I think this can resonate a lot with the president of Brazil that will need to have conversations with his new counterpart.
Yeah, I think those two seem to be certainly in photo ops and the optics between Macron and President Lula of late. They've been getting on quite well. Well, we'll talk to you shortly about Telegram. Before we get to that, I want to talk about what's happened on Monday evening. The streets of Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, several towns and cities across Israel full of protesters. The culmination of a nationwide strike which saw thousands of businesses, shopping malls, universities closed, major roads blocked, the main airport barely able to operate. Demonstrations which had started the night before, triggered by the news that six hostages had been killed in Gaza shortly before rescuers could get to them. Some furious families of the hostages accusing Benjamin Netanyahu of having blood on his hands, saying he knew the hostages were on borrowed time, that he knew about the orders to kill captives if there were rescue attempts and should have agreed a truce much earlier.
Both of you were here because six people that were alive and survived the agony of staying in Hamas captivity has lost their lives because the government can't make up her mind. And it seems like they forgot the Israeli ethics. That means mutual dependence on each other, mutual reliance on each other. And it seems like there's no one there that listens to us.
It seems like there's no one there that listens to us. Well, the response did come Monday night, a TV speech from the Prime Minister asking for forgiveness from the families for the loved one's death, but a defiance too, a justification for why he won't agree to a compromise that the US, his biggest backer, wants him to make.
I told the families, and I repeat it tonight too, I ask for your forgiveness for not bringing them back alive. We were close, but we didn't succeed. This corridor is different from other corridors, from other places. It's central. It determines our entire future. Its importance to us is great, but the world that wants the war to end, the last it wants is for us to enter it. And immense pressure will be put upon us.
Carolyn, what do you think it was about this moment that reignited such anger, so many people taking to the streets?
Well, to be very honest, I can only give my very personal reading of this because, of course, I don't know. I don't feel myself in the position to speak for the Israeli population. But I think seeing your prime minister who is waging warfare on a civil population that does not seem to be in any proportion anymore, saying that he is sorry for what he's done, while at the same time nobody actually believes anymore that a military intervention as such can solve this conflict and can bring the hostages home alive, I think this is the moment that people actually realize that there's something that doesn't match together. And I think this might have been a spark for this new kind of protest.
Richard, what's your reading of this, and what, if anything, can move the Prime Minister?
No, for a reason that we mentioned several times here since October 7. Netanyahu wants to survive politically. He has only one goal, which is to remain in power with his coalition linked to the extreme right, and he wants to win this war. But what does he mean to win? He wants to destroy the Gaza territory. He wants to destroy the Hamas completely. So he is able, when election time will come, to show a success. And the price of the success is the life of the hostages. And I think he's ready to pay that price. So now he's asking, I mean, he's apologizing, he's asking for forgiveness. But frankly speaking, politically, I think he's made another choice. The choice is to go as far as he can. And for the moment, the U.S., you're right, is asking for a ceasefire. But how many times the U.S. has been asking for a ceasefire? And so far, he did not clinch. So he will continue because he needs a military success, a final military success by October 7, the first anniversary of the assault and then the war on Gaza. And I think he will not back up. He will not back down. He has this goal because he knows if he stops now, he will be exposed not only to protest, not only to request to leave the political scene, but also to the Israeli judiciary.
Well, it's interesting because for the US, there are reports from the US that they are putting together what they call one final package to have some kind of ceasefire. And we remember, we talked about this many times before, Hamas were always blamed, often by Secretary of State Blinken, for saying no. But we had President Biden recently saying, could Netanyahu do more? One word, no. And you touched upon this. It wasn't just people on the streets, but politicians. Yoav Gallant, the defence minister, said to have had an absolute shouting match with Benjamin Netanyahu in the past few days about a ceasefire. Let's also have a listen to Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, talking to France 24 just a few days ago.
Certainly, I say, and it's not me, almost everyone in Israel says so, that Netanyahu is responsible for the erosion that led to the killing of these six people and the killing of many others that already were found before, and the ones that will be killed tomorrow and the day after tomorrow.
Nico, I just want your reading of this, and actually just covering something which, for every week we talk about a possible ceasefire, nothing comes to pass. We've seen these protests on the streets. We have a message of forgiveness, and yet a reiteration of the red line, which seems to be this, the importance of this Philadelphia corridor, having troops at the Egypt-Gaza border. Egypt border with Gaza, I should say, yeah.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that Netanyahu was moved to actually come out and beg for forgiveness, because I think that shows just how weak he is. I can't think of any comparable situation where a leader is so isolated as Netanyahu is now. I mean, even when Trump was in the White House and, you know, January 6th was going on, at least he had a kind of uprising of supporters and the kind of MAGA constituents who still supported him. It seems like virtually nobody is still supporting Bibi Netanyahu. Whichever side of the political spectrum you come from, you think that he's handled this badly. I don't think people were on the streets because they're concerned for the people of Gaza, sadly. They're on the streets because they think that he's directly responsible for killing the Israelis that have died. And don't think, so even if you're on the far right and you think, you know, that the operation should be blood and thunder all the way, you still think he should have managed to negotiate to get those hostages out. So I think he's in an incredibly vulnerable position. And I think that the US can, at this point, can push him over the line, because even with the Philadelphia corridor, as you've been saying, he says that it's an essential thing in order to make sure that there's peace and prosperity, because otherwise Hamas would smuggle things over from Egypt. And of course, with great timing, he announced, I think, was it yesterday, he suddenly announced that there was a plan for Sinwar to escape with hostages through the Philadelphia corridor, as a kind of example of why the Israelis should be able to keep control of this demilitarized zone. But he's being pinned and pinned and pinned and pinned into a tiny, tiny, tiny corner. And the only thing that's keeping him in power really is that the fact that the Biden White House, although it publicly will criticize him, continues to bankroll this military operation. And as you've seen from Britain starting to edge back from giving that total support, that's where Netanyahu really is now, on his very, very last legs.
That's a really good point, Nico. Richard, just a final thought on this. So you've got the British government at the moment, the new British government, the new Defence Secretary, saying that there are sanctions on 33 types of arms being sent to Israel, not all of them. How do you read the significance of that, if at all?
I have my doubt, and I would a bit disagree with Nico. I don't think, precisely because of the timetable, we are a month before the anniversary of October 7. And I think that makes Netanyahu way stronger, because he will continue and he will push, because if the US would really force him to leave before October 7, it could backfire. So I have the feeling that he is more powerful than we may think. I don't see him so vulnerable, but I may be wrong. I'm not an expert on the Middle East. Now, coming on to the UK, I think, unfortunately, but that has to go with history, Europeans do not have leverage in this conflict. Even with this sanction on arms, we simply,
even with
Europeans,
the politics of the UK and
we do
Israel.
Not have leverage, and we know why we don't have leverage, because we can't be united on, for example, sanctioning Israel or being tough on Netanyahu, for obvious reason, because how continental history, Germany history, puts them in a very difficult position. So unfortunately, I don't think we can expect anything from Europe on that conflict.
And very briefly, Germany is in a difficult position there.
Absolutely. I mean, Richard is absolutely right in what he's saying. But what I find interesting, the German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, she is just on a visit in the region today. And she met her Israeli counterpart, as well as the Israeli defense minister. And what she said was, of course, Israel's security is part of the German political DNA, and it will always be. What is not is the security of the Israeli government or certain persons in this government. So, rhetorically, we've come a long way in Germany. But then again, when it comes to actually desolidarizing with Israel. This is never going to happen for obvious and right reasons. But I think Richard has made a point. As Europe, we will never reach a common position on this kind of conflict.
Well, as Sergio mentioned a short while ago, going from the Middle East to Brazil, if you want to try and keep up with events from Brazil right now, in fact, if you're watching The World This Week or listening to the podcast, chances are you won't be tweeting or Xing the programme, because all this week, the social media site X, formerly Twitter, has been suspended. So if you are, you'll be using a VPN. And if you're caught using X in Brazil, the maximum fine is $8,700, about the same as grand theft charges in the US. Why? Because owner Elon Musk is not adhering to the Brazilian legal system, which requires disinformation from users on the site is taken down. The row snowballed from there. Elon Musk ignored court orders for X to name a legal representative, and the Supreme Court judge, Alessandra de Moraes, slapped a ban on the platform. Followed up Monday with a panel of judges and presidential involvement, essentially agreeing that though he may be one of the world's richest men, their laws matter and they will be adhered to. So many questions, and free speech is one of them. Mr. Musk calling himself a free speech absolutist. Critics call him a fair-weather liberal. So where is this all heading? Sergio, let's start with you in Brasilia and tell us what the week has been like with no access to X. What are people doing instead?
Well, people are trying to live their lives, I guess. Brazilians are very addicted, at least the ones that paid more attention to the news and politics, they're very addicted to Twitter, now X. And it has been a week to really try to find some place else to put their ideas and, you know, memes and stuff like that.
It's interesting about the VPN issue. How is that going down? The fact that it's nearly $9,000 if people are caught using them. Are you getting a sense that people are still using X with a VPN?
Well, some people are using X with a VPN. We got a few congressmen and congresswomen here saying they will challenge Alexandre de Moraes' court orders. So they are kind of outspoken about that. The issue with VPN is that if you use it in a very non-conspicuous way, it's very hard for people to catch you. So you need to be posting, you need to be liking, you need to be acting with the platform. If you just like lurking and seeing what other people are doing, it's very hard for you to get caught. And Alexandre de Moraes also clarified this week that it's only the fine will only be meant for people who are actively doing this to circumvent his decision. And not to find people that are just watching and seeing what's happening in the social media.
So lurking is the key. Lurking around, see what other people are doing, and then maybe gingerly do it. But it's a big fine. Just your take as well, Sergio, on the fact that you've got those defending Elon Musk and him himself tweeting lots of things of insults like calling Moraes the Justice, Darth Vader or Voldemort. Who say that this man, this justice, has gone for very high-profile cases in the past, that this is political, and yet we have the panel of judges agreeing with him.
Yes, we did. On Monday, a panel of judges from the Supreme Court agreed with him. It was not all the other justices, but it was a separate panel that Alexandre de Moraes is a part of. And they all agree with him, and the social media is down here in Brazil. So this was kind of a way to emphasize Alexandre de Moraes' decision and say that he's kind of right in this fight. A lot of people here complain about how forceful he was with this and how his investigation around disinformation in Brazil is going.
Yeah.
It's very unusual for the Supreme Court to take on a full investigation. This is the work of police and the public ministry here. And a lot of people are critical of that. And this has given ammunition for them to keep criticizing him.
Sergio, There are so many questions that we want to ask you. I'm going to bring in Caroline as well, because I know you have questions too for Sergio. But just to bear in mind that this is the biggest market in Latin America, X in Brazil. You know, we're not talking about the Marshall Islands here. This is huge, and it's like fourth or fifth biggest market in the world. Caroline.
Excuse me.
What are your thoughts? I know you had lots for Sergio. When it comes to this row and the question that being asked, is the country right to switch off X? What are you thinking?
Well, I think that you cannot deny that X has kind of become a place that is not as regulated anymore as, in my opinion, it should be at times, because there's a lot of hate going on. There's a lot of false information being disseminated. But then again, I don't think that a decision to close down such a place as a whole is the best way to handle this question, to be very honest, without actually pretending to have a better solution. But I think it's not the way we should go.
We hear Elon Musk call himself a free speech absolutist. And yet, as you will know, Richard, if you go over to India and Narendra Modi, the prime minister who asked Elon Musk to take down some content, a BBC documentary. True. He took down that content.
Yes, because he's a tycoon and he's looking after his commercial interest everywhere. Now, I would have one question for our Brazilian colleague. Certainly, X committed abuses in terms of language, hate, and so on. But what about other social media platforms in Brazil? Should we say that X is definitely going further than other social media platforms? Or is it because it's Elon Musk that the judge has decided to take such a decision?
So this is a very good question, Richard. First of all, in not only my opinion, but I guess in the opinion of a lot of political commentators and specialists in Brazil, this is not a freedom of speech question here. This is a compliance with the judicial system question, right? If the judicial system had a decision, organizations and people need to comply with that decision. It's not about freedom of speech. You can fight for freedom of speech in the judicial system. You can go to the press. You can make a fuss about it. You can do a lot of stuff. But you need to comply with the highest court in Brazil. Right? I'm not going to defend Alexandre de Moraes, which has made a lot of questionable decisions in the past few years. He's one of the most powerful people in Brazil. But in this case, he had his hands tied. You know, what can he do for this organization, for this company to comply with a Supreme Court decision? And the way he thought it was the way to go was shutting down the social media here in Brazil. So it's more of a compliance to the law and judicial decisions than necessarily freedom of speech, right?
Very interesting as well. Nico, just to bring you in, just listening to both Rich and Sergio there. Sergio, I've heard on Sergio's blog before, he's talked about how Starlink and the surveillance actually that Elon Musk has in Brazil, you could actually work out where troop movements are. So they are talking about dealing with a powerful player here who could be part of Donald Trump's government if he wins office. What's your reading of these events in Brazil, and where are you? Which side are you falling down on at the moment?
Well, I think it's very interesting hearing Richard talking about him being a tycoon looking after his commercial interests. But of course, Elon Musk has done an absolutely terrible job of looking after his commercial interests with Twitter, or X, as he likes to call it, by his... He may have lost 90% of the value of the company since he bought it. And that's only going to continue to tank if he loses major markets like Brazil. You know, we're not just talking about a large country. We're talking about maybe a fifth of Twitter's overall users, by some estimates, are in Brazil. And, you know, okay, a few people will use VPNs, but basically this must have absolutely wiped off an enormous percentage of the users over there. And I think at the end of the day, Elon Musk... is so stubborn and so attracted to his own headlines that he can't resist taking on these fights, even when they're basically harming the health of his company and his own bottom line. You know, he's not doing this because he's so clever, because he really genuinely believes in something. He's just doing it because he's got a bee in his bonnet and he doesn't want to back down. Yeah. So I think it's going to end up hurting him ultimately. And there's no way that countries can just say, okay, fine, you don't have to obey the law anymore. I mean, you know, Brazil didn't have any choice. You can't just allow a company to say we're above the law. So ultimately, he's shot himself in the foot and he's only got himself to blame.
Back of fag packet calculations, I think he took over X Twitter, which is worth about $44 billion. It's now valued around, generous guesses, $22 billion. So what's 20-odd billion lost to a billionaire? Next. It became clear last Sunday night the often formulaic, non-newsworthy East German elections was about to make global headlines. TV exit polls showing the AfD party becoming the first far-right organisation since the Nazis in the Second World War to win a state, the state of Thuringia. They came a close second too in the state of Saxony. This is a party that other far-right parties don't want to be keeping company with. Marine Le Pen, the leader of the French National Rally, chucked the group out of their European bloc. Too extreme for the extremes. And Björn Höcke, the AfD's leader in Thuringia, convicted of using banned Nazi slogans. Well, this was him celebrating in Thuringia on the night.
It doesn't matter whether you vote yellow, red, green or black. You will just get more EU, more climate policies, more deindustrialization, more immigration, more multiculti. You will get more war rhetoric. People don't want this anymore.
So the politics means it's unlikely the group will take power. Other parties still keep a cordon sanitaire around them, a firewall. But with 10-15% of the vote also going to a populist hard left, Serdar Wagenknecht alliance, whose anti-immigrant pro-Russia stances chime with the AfD's, the coalition building is a necessity now. Chaotic politics lies ahead. Let's bring in Caroline first of all. Now, you could say this only represents, what, 7% of the population of Germany, but how significant should we read this?
Well, I was shocked by the election results, but it was not really a surprise, to be honest. I mean, we've seen it a long way coming because it's been years that this party, especially in this German federal state, has been gaining voter shares and it's always just gone up. So not a big surprise. I think it is significant in the sense that it forces other political parties to actually rethink how they are going to handle this very fact. And you mentioned it, the formation of a government in Thuringia will be a goddamn nightmare. Because either they go all together, which is not going to happen, or no one knows what's going to happen. So just until now, it's kind of difficult because especially the conservatives, they have a lot of internal regulations that forbid certain kind of alliances. So we will have to see what's going on with this. It's going to be a bookcase, I guess, for the future handling of this political party. And I think what we need now is actually to not to only accept it as a political fact, but to see how are we going to act with this actor. And this is the qualitative difference, I think.
East German elections are often different to elections elsewhere in Germany. And I'm just interested in your view, Richard, as to why you think the AfD and its leader, it seems to command an audience, has tapped into something there. What they've done? It's immigration, right?
It's, I guess, for sure immigration, but not only. It's a matter, as the leader of the AfD said, about deindustrialization or the feeling of being left aside, which is, I checked the map and I checked the figures. It's actually not true because a number of big factories have been moving east in the last years. So so East Germany is not that left aside as the AfD says. Now, in terms of new political actors, we should, and especially the other German party, should think of how acting with the AfD, but also with the Sarah Wagenknecht party, because the other political actor which gained from this election is the radical left led by Sarah Wagenknecht, and she has the party after her name, which is something in a democracy that you should always be careful about. So I think, yes, it's maybe frightening in a way, but we've got to see how the other political party respond. But clearly the answer from Berlin, from the headquarters of this different political parties going to be very important, especially from the Conservative Party, because everybody believes that the CDU-CSU will lead the next government in Germany after the September election in 2025.
And that is the big question. Nico, we have about 30 seconds left, but I do want to get your thoughts about this, particularly on Sarah Wagenknecht here, because there are some links, people say, that she's linked to, you know, a Venn diagram with Marine Le Pen. She's on the left, but she's got ideas of the right on immigration, whereas Marine Le Pen's come from the right, getting towards ideas of the left. What's your readout there?
Well, I think the good news for us is that these people are all a bit self-obsessed and they're going to kind of fall out with each other. You know, Bjorn Höcke, they were trying to kick him out of the AfD because he was too extreme even for the AfD, which gives you a clue about his own personal positions. He's been, you know, as you said, been found guilty and been fined. And I think the same will happen on the left. You know, it'll fracture and they won't be able to come up with a strong movement. The real danger, if you're fearing kind of anti-immigration clapdowns, is people like Michel Barnier being the acceptable face of anti-immigration. So I think these groups will just remain as pressure groups, pushing the mainstream parties to doing increasingly radical things. But I don't think we'll ever have these guys in power themselves.
Nico, great to talk to you. Thank you, Nico, Caroline, Richard, Sergio as well. We'll be back in 7 days. For a quick nod to Sergio, actually, in Brazil, the news this week, in fact, as we've been on air, the Brazilian singer-artist Sergio Mendes has died at the age of 83. The man who made famous one of the biggest worldwide hits ever released wasn't originally his song, Mas Que Nada, but it's his version with his band Brazil 66 that is, for many, the definitive version of the song. We'll see you next week, and we'll lead out with a tribute to Sergio Mendes.